a shadow trade system to what the U.S., the sort of Western financial system that is the predicate for punishing Iran via sanctions.
And Jeff, very quickly, we have 30 seconds. What happened to the 2021 plan to overhaul the U.S. sanctions system?
Yeah, we exclusively report in our story that a group of Treasury staffers had a draft of a report far more extensive than what they ultimately released. They had dozens of recommendations, including measures really meant to check the rise of U.S. sanctions, particularly a sort of central coordinator. Right now, it's a little bureaucratic, but there are sort of many parts of the government that sort of throw out sanctions ideas. They get rolled together in State Department and Treasury Department sanctions and push forward. And there's really no one body that sort of is evaluating whether these sanctions are operating in the context of an overall broader sanction strategy. And Treasury staffers drew up a plan to say, like, let's put that in place. But disagreements with the State Department, sort of the overall inertia of sanctions, where they seem so easy, so effective, they seem to the U.S. government much easier than going to war, much easier than doing nothing, or much more politically palatable than doing nothing. And so that plan was shelved, and really under the Biden administration, we've just seen more and more sanctions. Biden has imposed 6,000 sanctions in 2 years, an unprecedented sum. And the fact that has continued really reflects the inability of the U.S. to get this problem or to get this number down.
Jeff Stein, we thank you so much for being with us. Reporter for The Washington Post will link to your piece, How Four U.S. Presidents Unleashed Economic Warfare Across the Globe.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
The 2024 election is coming, and we at KBOO want to make sure your voice is heard. Take KBOO's election agenda survey and help our volunteer reporters and programmers cover the 2024 election. We want to know, what do you want candidates to be talking about as they compete for votes? Fill out our survey by August 14th, and you can be entered into a sweepstakes to win a $50 Visa gift card. Full rules on our website. At the end of August, we'll report back with the community's priorities. Find that survey online at bit.ly/KBOOSurvey2024. That's bit.ly/KBOOSurvey24.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a heat wave, dry conditions, and windy weather could add up to more trouble for an overheated wildfire season in Oregon. Oregon reaches a compromise on a court challenge over its treatment of young people in foster care. And more Oregon nurses warn they may have to hit the picket lines. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, August 1st, 2024. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. Oregon's foster youth system was under legal fire, but now the state's reached a settlement before a trial was about to start, focusing on the harms of the state's care system. Eric Tegedoff explains now current and former foster youth will get a voice on how to improve Oregon's system.
The Oregon Department of Human Services has agreed to a settlement in a class action lawsuit filed by foster children. As part of the agreement, foster youth and anyone who has aged out of care since 2019 when the suit was filed will get a chance to share their feedback about the settlement with U.S. District Judge Ann Aiken on September 12th. Emily Cooper is legal director for Disability Rights Oregon, one of the organizations that filed the initial lawsuit.
They have an opportunity to say, I think the state should also maybe do these other things, or the state should really focus on this. And the court and we really want to hear from these children and young adults.
A listening session is being held today at 5 p.m. and Saturday at 1 p.m. to provide instructions on how to share feedback. Cooper notes nearly 5,000 people will be eligible to participate. Those wanting to share must sign up online by August 15th or send a letter to Judge Aiken by August 16th. Cooper says the state needs to make drastic changes to the foster care system. The initial suit was filed because of concerns about kids being abused, neglected, and going without essential services. She says the state has agreed to make certain changes over the next 10 years.
Making sure that kids aren't cycling in and out of the system, going home, coming back. That's called reentry. It's making sure they have case plans within the first 2 months of entering care. Making sure they get the services like medical, dental, mental health care when they're in care.
Cooper says she shared the agreement with one of the women involved in the case, and she told Cooper she cried after reading it.
She said, because if all of these promises that are in this agreement had been kept before I entered care, I wouldn't have the scars I have. So I think this is not just for me, but every single kid like me.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Wildfires have already scorched more than 1.2 million acres of Oregon land this summer. Now, with a new heat wave moving in, firefighting experts warn of increased risk of new fires sparking, plus conditions that will keep feeding the ones currently burning. Jeff Shelton is an expert in wildfire behavior. Right now, he's working on the Pyramid and Slate wildfires in central Oregon.
As we move forward, the fuels are going to dry. They're going to become more available in the region. You're seeing signs of higher risk, lightning and convection. As we look at fire, there's really only two choices to put this fire out. The fire has to be starved of its energy, or it has to burn into something that is so wet it just saps the fire of its energy. We're taking advantage of some of these wetter features, these creek beds, to basically act as nature's fire hose to extinguish the fire. You have seen also where the fire has been able to cross those stream beds and has some alignment with slope. And that's what we're really watching in the next couple of days when it gets hotter and drier. We have been able to go direct and take advantage and exploit this weather over the last couple of days. When we look at another part of this fire to the north, we see a very similar picture where you have a very steep terrain and you can see the challenges we have. So looking forward, just understand that we've been enjoying weather that has not been really rowdy, but it's going to get more and more unfriendly over the next 4 or 5 days. And you're going to should expect to see some more smoke in the sky as materials on the interior consume and put that smoke out.
Senate Republicans today blocked a bipartisan bill that would boost tax credits for parents. As the GOP and Democrats feud over comments from Republican vice presidential nominee Senator J.D. Vance, the senators voted 48 to 44 to advance the bill co-authored by Oregon Senator Ron Wyden. It would have raised the child tax credit, ended the employee retention tax credit, and reinstated other tax credits for businesses. Shortly before the vote, Wyden pushed for support from at least 60 senators to overcome the hurdle.
Republicans are talking a lot these days, trying to convince Americans that they're the ones who support children and families, not Democrats. The Republicans talk about supporting small businesses. They talk about how terrible it is that nobody can afford a home in America. And they talk about cracking down on fraud in government programs. The bill that the Senate will vote on in a few minutes helps with each and every one of these issues. Now we're going to see whether Senate Republicans really, in fact, do want to help, whether they're offering anything more than talk. Over the last couple of days, I've read lots of comments from Republican senators who say that it's really time to wait, and if Republicans take control of the Senate, they'll write a better bill. So I would ask, better for whom? One thing I'm sure of is it won't be a better bill for the 16 million kids who stand to benefit today, colleagues, from the proposal we are going to vote on. And it won't come as any comfort to families who are getting clobbered on rent or the small businesses. They're going to fail if they don't get help now. The House of Representatives passed this bill back in January. It was the product of work with Republican Chair Jason Smith and I, but it also included a year's worth of negotiation with colleagues here in the Senate. That bill got 357 votes, almost an even split between the two parties. The House of Representatives at this point, it'd be hard to get 357 votes if you're just out ordering a piece of pie. The only reason our bipartisan bill didn't become law 6 months ago was because of the delay of Senate Republicans. I offered to make changes. I met with a significant number of Senate Republicans personally. They talked about what their proposed ideas were for compromise, although they looked a little bit like the dog that caught the car. Senate Republicans just continued the delays. But for the millions of people who are hurting, those folks can't afford for the Senate to just keep waiting. Now, the reality is, when it comes to tax policy debates, this is the easy stuff. The difficult issues don't get agreement from 357 members of the House of Representatives. The debate on taxes is sure to get a lot harder when Congress is going to have to deal with trillions of dollars in tax changes coming down the pike. If Senate Republicans can't work across the aisle or work with a House that produced 357 votes, it's going to be some very heavy lifting next year. Every senator now has a choice. The results here are not predetermined. Republicans can choose to side with children and families. Republicans can choose to side with people who are walking an economic tightrope, just trying to pay the rent. Importantly, Republicans can choose to side with small businesses. The fact is, the problems small businesses are having today, to a great extent, are due to the single-handed efforts of Senate Republicans who did nothing to block an effort to derail the research and development credit. They were willing to derail the research and development credit in the 2017 tax bill when everybody said, we need this to compete with China. Senate Republicans said, nah, we're interested in giving tax breaks to people at the top rather than small businesses. So the research and development tax credit for small business, not a single Democrat voted for it. And then they promised to fix it in 2018, in 2019, 2020, 2021, 2022, 2023, and 2024. All those years, Senate Republicans said they'd get a break for small businesses on the research and development issue. Now a lot of those small businesses have to go out and borrow to keep their doors open. So we offered to work that and other issues out, but Republicans said, gee, we're just going to wait around till 2025. I want to say to my colleagues and I want to say to the country, a lot of these small business, the research and development issue is a lifeline. I've had them come to me and say, Ron, I'm not even going to be around in 2025 for somebody like the Senate Republicans who wants to wait. I say we ought to help them now. And make no mistake about it, a Senate that passes this legislation can allow our bill to go to the President of the United States right away. And help goes out to those 16 million families, the 4 million small businesses that depend on the research and development credit, the families that got clobbered with disasters. We have a chance to help those families.
After the vote failed, Senator Wyden accused Republicans of not following through on their promises to help children and families. Idaho Republican Mike Crapo accused the Democrats of a, quote, cynical political ploy. Meantime, Washington U.S. Senator Patty Murray's also in the thick of negotiations. She's the chair of the Appropriations Committee that funds the government. She shared her thoughts on a plan she says will strengthen the economy, make families' lives easier, propel cutting-edge research, and keep the country safe.
By working together, finding common ground, and rejecting dangerous cuts and extreme policy, we have once again produced strong bipartisan bills that increase support for families, strengthen our national security, invest in our economy and competitiveness, and can actually be signed into law. These bills make common sense investments in programs that make a real difference for our nation's future. There are investments here that strengthen our economy through workforce development, cutting-edge scientific and biomedical research, support for small business, and major support for our infrastructure and waterways that are crucial to trade, agriculture, and more. There are investments in these bills to make families' lives a little easier and help parents make ends meet, like increased funding for childcare, our K-12 public schools, and to help students get a higher education, support for community health care and public health work, resources to make sure families can afford heating and AC, and much more. There are investments to protect our environment, whether it's restoring ecosystems for key species like salmon, addressing extreme weather dangers like flooding, or environmental cleanup like at the Hanford nuclear site. And there are investments to protect people in every corner of the country, protect our nation, and protect our democracy, whether that be protecting consumers from fraud, protecting communities from opioids and pandemics, protecting our electrical grid from cyber attacks, protecting our elections from bad actors and foreign interference, or protecting our nation with strong strategic defense investments.
Vice President and presidential candidate Kamala Harris delivered the eulogy for longtime Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee today. She passed away at the age of 74 from pancreatic cancer. Here's part of the speech Harris gave at a memorial service in Houston.
Sheila Jackson Lee, to know her was to know a true champion, a fierce champion for justice. Sheila Jackson Lee was a woman of deep faith and deep compassion. She was a proud member of our beloved Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority Incorporated, and she was a dear friend to my husband Doug and me. Over her career, Sheila had many titles: judge, council member, congresswoman, and yet perhaps the titles she cherished the most were wife to Elwin, mother to Jason and Erica, and BB to Ellison and Roy. And so to the entire Lee family, Doug and my prayers are with you. Sheila was just a presence. She was a presence. And it is not easy, and I say to the family, when a loved one lives a life of public service, and so especially someone like Sheila Jackson Lee, and I want to thank the family on behalf of the people of our nation for your sacrifices and the work that you did to support her over these many years that allowed her to give so much to our country. So the Bible teaches us, whatever you do, work at it with all your heart, as if you were working for the Lord. In everything she did, Sheila Jackson Lee worked with all her heart. As a member of the United States Senate and the Congressional Black Caucus, I had the honor to work directly with Sheila on many issues over the years and to observe firsthand her leadership. And she truly was a force of nature. When it came to her constituents, there was no task too big or too small for the Congresswoman. If it needed to be done, she made sure it was done and done right. When it came to crafting policy, there was no detail too minor or point of order too obscure. If it needed to be understood, the Congresswoman would make sure everyone understood it and understood it well and used it to the benefit of the people she served. To know her was to marvel at her mastery of the legislative process. Sheila Jackson Lee was one of the smartest and most strategic legislators in Washington, D.C. And I will say, and we all who have worked with her and had the blessing of work with her know, she was also one of the most unrelenting As those of us who were her colleagues can attest, there was never a trite or trivial conversation with Sheila Jackson Lee.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In Depth. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather, a heat advisory is in effect, mostly clear skies, down to an overnight low of 67. Tomorrow's weather, partly cloudy skies, a high of 93. For today in history, I have a special guest helping me out. History professor Dr. Chris Nichols and I talked about a woman who blazed a trail.
August 1st, 1980, Vigdis Finnbogadottir takes office in Iceland. She was the world's first democratically elected female head of state. And I think if you look around the world, there have been others since who have been elected. And now we're on the precipice of making a decision of maybe we will finally, the U.S. will finally be doing that. What's the importance of having a female head of state for a democratically elected country?
I think representation matters. I've come to this more and more as a historian and in thinking about American politics. Having people who look like you, act like you, matter for, say, kids growing up, having ambitions and goals. If you read some children's books, they have accounts of you can be like this person, that person. You add a Harris to that list as a president. Right now, as a vice president, she's pathbreaking and she's already on those lists. So there's that. Some countries, Margaret Thatcher in England comes to mind, have had conservative women leaders. Indira Gandhi, Isabel Perón in Argentina comes to mind. Conservative, very liberal, socialist across the board. The U.S. has come a little bit late to that, frankly. American democracy hasn't elevated a woman to the highest office. So it feels past due, frankly, if you look at the list of who has run and who's been president or vice president, that Harris was the first female vice president. I think that matters a lot. Representation matters for the country, I think. Then the other piece of the puzzle in thinking about this day in history, if I'm not usurping, is thinking about women's right to vote and the 19th Amendment. And thinking about the ways in which having women in office and women's issues at the forefront are also critical, whether they're conservative or liberal. And so one of the ideas in 1919 and 1920, when the 19th Amendment passed in Congress in 1919 and ratified in 1920, giving women the vote, basically mostly white women the vote, was that women's issues would come to the forefront and could actually be pursued more centrally through that vote. So that by having electing representatives who had their values, they could pursue those public policies. What happened was that women tended to vote along the same lines demographically, sociologically as men. And so while the women's vote did matter, it didn't foreground women's issues in politics in the ways that people thought or stipulated. But I think that actually having women leaders does that. So when women leaders, as we were talking about Harris speaking about the connections between individual rights and women's reproductive rights, I think that in office, actually in that leadership role, does put forward issues that you might call women's issues or identity types of politics. When you have LGBTQ plus folks embodied, literally embodied in those positions, they then can foreground them in their public policies and in their rhetoric in ways that the simple vote doesn't actually translate to. And I think that's an important thing for us to remember as we think about this anniversary.
Dr. Chris Nichols is a history professor at The Ohio State University. He also worked at Oregon State University for 10 years. Former President Donald Trump questions Kamala Harris's race and makes derogatory remarks about her husband. Librarians worry about Project 2025's impacts, and congressional Republicans promise to roadblock President Biden's Supreme Court reforms. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2024 Talks.
She was always of Indian heritage, and she was only promoting Indian heritage. I didn't know she was black until a number of years ago when she happened to turn black, and now she wants to be known as black. So I don't know, is she Indian or is she black?
Former President Donald Trump called Vice President Kamala Harris's race into question at the National Association of Black Journalists convention in Chicago. Trump has made racially charged comments about Harris before, calling her a DEI diversity hire, saying she doesn't like Jewish people, and calling her husband Doug Emhoff a crappy Jew. Emhoff responded on social media saying Trump's comments show a worse version of an already horrible person. Democrats are calling on Republican lawmakers to condemn what they call racist and anti-Semitic statements, but some also say they're not surprised, since they expected the race to develop an ugly undercurrent once the vice president replaced President Joe Biden as the presumptive nominee. Harris has always spoken of herself as black, and White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre says no one has the right to tell another person how to identify.
Only she can speak to her experience. Only she can speak to what it's like. She's the only person that can do that. And I think it's insulting for anybody. It doesn't matter if it's a former leader, a former president.
Though the former president is disavowing Project 2025, many charge the hard right second term roadmap would still play a central role if he's reelected. Librarians say they're worried by its call to close the Institute of Museums and Library Services, which distributes the only federal funding specifically set aside for public and state libraries. Peter Bromberg with the group Every Library says it comes at a bad time.
But that threat of criminal penalties on top of these threats of what you can or can't say and the encouragement to censor would discourage educators and school librarians from providing a variety of diverse material.
As the election nears, threats of violence at poll sites have increased, but 15 states in the District of Columbia now prohibit firearms where people vote. Massachusetts Governor Maura Healey has just signed legislation to ban guns within 150 feet of polling sites on Election Day and during early voting. Jeff Foster is with Common Cause Massachusetts.
They're sending a clear message that voters should be able to cast a ballot without fear, and that local election officials should be able to administer an election safely without having to worry about intimidation.
Colorado and Vermont have also banned guns at the polls this year, while New Mexico banned open carry. Congressional Republicans say they'll block President Biden's sweeping changes to the Supreme Court. Biden says he'll devote the rest of his time in office to passing term limits and an enforceable ethics code. But Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell says what Biden is proposing is actually a stealth process to change some specific court rulings.
President Biden and his leftist allies don't like the current composition of the court, so they want to shred the Constitution to change it.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira.
Nurses at a hospital in Newport, Oregon say they're not getting a fair deal. Eric Tegedov tells us the nurses at Samaritan Pacific Communities Hospital say they get lower pay than others in the company, and they want to do something about it.
Nurses with an expired union contract in Oregon are holding an informational picket on Friday. Negotiations on a contract with Samaritan Pacific Communities Hospital in Newport started in April, but the two sides have yet to reach a deal. The nurses are represented by the Oregon Nurses Association. Their contract expired on June 30th. Brooke Clark is a registered nurse at the hospital and member of the union. She wants Samaritan to bring its pay up equal to other Samaritan hospitals. Clark also notes that about a quarter of staff are traveling nurses.
That cost is really going to eat into our budget as an organization, and that cost is going to eventually trickle down to our patients and our community.
Traveling nurses are paid more than local nurses. The Oregon Nurses Association notes Samaritan Pacific Communities Hospital is one of the most profitable hospitals in the state. A bargaining session takes place on Friday. The nurses also have an informational picket planned for Friday. Samaritan did not respond before the deadline for this story. Clark says housing, childcare, and other living costs are higher in Newport. She says the hospital has struggled to stay fully staffed at times.
Even with the travelers, we still have very regular holes in our staffing that are due to the fact that we can't recruit and retain nurses out here on the coast.
Clark says the nurses at her hospital do the same work as other nurses in the Samaritan system, and their wages should reflect that.
It really comes down to just the principle of things. It comes down to treating our nurses equally, fairly, and treating us with respect.
Nurses at Samaritan Albany General Hospital reached a deal with their managers on a new contract earlier this week. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
An executive order for the transport of radioactive material on Navajo land. A new program seeks to fill a healthcare gap with indigenous recruits, and a native victim of a Brewer Stadium accident is honored in a ceremony. With these stories and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
Navajo Nation President Boo Nigrin issued an executive order Wednesday requiring an agreement to be in place prior to the transportation of radioactive material through the Navajo Nation. The order comes after the tribe says two trucks with uranium ore traveled through the Navajo Nation Tuesday. Tribal police attempted to halt the transportation, but the trucks made it from Arizona to Utah. According to the tribe, the owner of a mine near the Grand Canyon did not provide notice to Navajo officials. The tribe says there are Navajo laws in place regarding the transportation of radioactive materials to ensure public safety. Nigrin calls the transportation illegal and says failure to seek approval disregards tribal sovereignty. The order will be in effect for 6 months. There's a new program helping Indigenous people enter the medical field. The Mountain West News Bureau's Hannah Merzbach reports it's a way to funnel tribal members into careers and fill healthcare gaps.
The online 3 to 6 month trainings are stepping stones into the healthcare world. Carla Coleman is with Health Tech Academy, a for-profit company that helps fill staffing shortages. Now it's partnering with the Jackson, Wyoming-based nonprofit Native American Jumpstart to find Indigenous students across the Cowboy State, Great Plains, and the Navajo Nation. Enrolled tribal members can apply for grants that could make the entire program free.
We're not only able to help people start in this industry, but we can also help them build their own community by staying in their community.
Compared to other U.S. populations, Indigenous peoples see higher mortality rates and more chronic conditions, partly due to being far away from quality care. Coleman says she hopes this partnership could help bridge that gap. I'm Hannah Mersbach.
A Native American man who was one of three iron workers who died in a construction accident 25 years ago this summer was recently remembered at a public ceremony. Chuck Kornbach reports.
William DeGrave, Jeffrey Wisher, and Jerome Starr died in July 1999 when the so-called man basket they were in crashed to the ground. That was after a crane was unable to control a 450-ton piece of metal roofing being lifted in a strong wind. The construction project was a new Major League Baseball stadium, now called American Family Field, where the Milwaukee Brewers play. Jerome Starr was Ojibwe. Part of a recent ironworkers-sponsored remembrance ceremony outside the ballpark included tribal member Maynard Webster performing an honor song. Later, Starr's sister, Catherine Hamilton Starr, choked up while talking to a reporter about her relative.
He was a great brother. He was always providing for everybody, always cared about everybody. He was very caring. He was always there in need of anything, very close.
Standing next to Catherine was her daughter, Jerome Starr's niece, Dawn Hamilton, who tearfully relayed a favorite memory.
Going over to Uncle Jerry's house in the summertime to go swimming.
Yeah.
And then the holidays or whatever, he always opened up his home. Everybody in the family, everybody and anybody was welcome. He kept us united.
Hamilton and others also took part in a smudging ceremony to pray for the deceased. Hamilton says she's grateful all of those who passed away building